This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Jeremy Rifkin. Jeremy is president of the Foundation on Economic Trends and author of 17 best-selling books on the impact of scientific and technological changes on the economy, the workforce, society, and the environment. Recent books include The European Dream, The Hydrogen Economy, The End of Work, The Biotech Century, and The Age of Access. He is an advisor to the European Union and heads of state around the world and is a senior lecturer at the Wharton School's Executive Education Program at the University of Pennsylvania. Jeremy Rifkin is here today to tell us about his most recent book, The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World in Crisis. Welcome, Jeremy.
Nice to be here with you.
It's good to have you. What led you to write your book, The Empathic Civilization?
I believe that we may be at a seminal turning point in the history of our species, and that the next several decades might decide our fate, really, on this planet. In the last 18 months, we've had two major events which I think signal the beginning of the end game for the great industrial age of the last two centuries. You remember back in July 2008, oil hit $147 a barrel on world markets. Prices soared, inflation roared, and basic items from food to gasoline became prohibitively expensive. There were actually food riots in 30 countries at that time, and purchasing power simply plummeted. The economic engine of globalization totally turned off at $147 a barrel because everything's made from fossil fuels. Our petrochemical fertilizers and pesticides for foods, most of our clothes, our pharmaceutical products, our construction materials, etc. So in July 2008, at $147 a barrel, we had peak globalization for the industrial age. That was the end game. That was the meltdown of the economy. That was the earthquake. The collapse of the financial market 60 days later, that was the aftershock. So our world leaders are still dealing with the aftershock, and they haven't come to grips with the earthquake, which was the collapse of the industrial age based on fossil fuels. It's clearly on life supports now. Then fast forward to December 2009. Copenhagen. World leaders come together after years of negotiations on climate change to address the entropy bill for the industrial age, the spent CO2 from two centuries of industrial use of fossil fuels. And even though our scientists say that we're imperiled, we may see mass extinction of life on this planet by the turn of the century, our own species is now in jeopardy. Despite all of that, our world leaders were unable to come to an agreement to reduce carbon emissions. It collapsed in Copenhagen. So here's the question. Why was it that our world leaders were simply unable to anticipate or respond to the meltdown of the Industrial Revolution? And secondly, why were they unable to respond effectively to climate change and cut a deal, even though this is the greatest threat that's ever faced the human species? I think the fault lies deeper than just finding new mechanisms to arrange the global economy or new carbon agreements to deal with climate change. The real fault lies in the fact that our world leaders are using a set of 18th century assumptions about human nature that were spawned in the Enlightenment at the dawn of the market economy in the nation-state era to address 21st century biosphere challenges and a global economy. And it's those old, outworn, antiquated ideas about human nature and the human journey that are getting us deeper and deeper into trouble and threaten really our ability to function on this planet.
Your book talks about empathy. Would you define empathy?
Well, let me place it slightly in context, because I think to get to empathy, we have to talk a little bit about what these values are we've been living by. You know, the Enlightenment philosopher said that human nature is basically self-interested. We're born as rational, detached, autonomous agents. We seek individually to pursue our self-interest. We're materialistic directed. We're pleasure-seeking. We're utilitarian, etc. Now, if that really is what human nature is all about, utilitarian, self-interested, materialistic, autonomous, calculating, rational, and detached, we're likely doomed. I mean, I really don't see how 6.8 billion people are going to come together and create a seamless, just and sustainable global economy and address climate change and steward the planet if that's who our real nature is. But what's been interesting in the last 10 or 15 years, below the radar screen, our scientists have been coming through with some breakthrough discoveries which are forcing us to challenge these traditional ideas about what human nature is really all about. Our scientists are discovering that human beings and some of the primates are wired for empathic distress. We actually, in our biology, we are actually born with neurons that allow us to actually experience another's plight, another's condition, another's feeling as if we were experiencing it ourselves. Their pain, their joy, their pleasure, their frustration, even their sense of disgust, rejection, that when we observe somebody else feeling these things, our own neurons light up as if we were feeling them. So we have began to discover in evolutionary biology and neurocognitive science that we are homoempathicus. Now, I guess we should have known this all along, because the worst thing you can do to a person is isolate them and ostracize them. We're social animals. Our primary drive is to be connected, to feel each other's experience, and to have solidarity. If those drives aren't met in parenting and by the society and culture, the secondary drives come in. And the secondary drives are aggression, violence, narcissism, utilitarianism, materialism. So if we are really homoempathicus, and that's our core nature, then the question is there a way to take that empathic biology that we're built with and find a way to extend it to the entire human family and our fellow creatures so we can actually create a sustainable world and learn to live in this biosphere? And that is the starting point for the book, for the empathic civilization.
How much of the empathy is actually innate as opposed to needing to be learned?
It's both. It's wired into our biology, but it has to be learned. You know, when little babies are in a nursery and one baby hears another baby's cry, the babies will all start crying, but they don't know why, but it's built into their primitive empathic distress. About 2.5 years of age, a child begins to understand who they are in the mirror. They can have self-reflection and identity. That's the key. Selfhood goes hand in hand with empathy. The more one develops a sense of self and selfhood and individuality, the more one understands and can sensitize with someone else's selfhood as an identifiable person. Around 8, a child learns about birth and death, that they have one and only life, that they're fragile and vulnerable, that life doesn't go on forever. And that existential sense of one's fragile existence, their one and only life, allows each of us to empathize with other people's one and only life. So when we empathize with someone, it's not a utopian value. It's very, very based on suffering, and life is tough. It's hard to be alive. So when I empathize with another human or another creature, I feel their fragility, their vulnerability, their one and only life, and I try to root for them and celebrate their opportunity to flourish and be and to struggle to live. So empathy is a very complicated phenomenon. You don't find empathy in heaven or in paradise or utopia because there's no suffering and there's no mortality. So empathy is a very, very human-oriented condition. In the book, in the empathic civilization, I take a different read in history because, you know, our historians chronicle all the bad things in history. The wars, the devastation, the Holocaust, the power struggles, the redress of grievances. Why do they do that? Because it's newsworthy. But these are newsworthy events because they're not ordinary events. That's why we single them out. So our historians really chronicle the pathology of history, but there's another history that they've overlooked, and it's the deeper history, and that is the evolution of empathic consciousness over history. We have developed more and more empathy across broader domains over history. And so the empathic civilization, the book's an attempt to look at this other history and how it comes about. What are the mechanisms and processes that make it happen? If we can understand those mechanisms and processes, maybe we can create a sustainable community, a sustainable world.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Jeremy Rifkin, author of the book The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World in Crisis. Would you like to go into some detail about the tendency for empathy changing over time and how it has changed?
It's very interesting because, you know, the way we think today, the way our brains are wired in the 21st century, our consciousness, totally different than a medieval serf. And their consciousness would be totally different than a forager hunter 30,000 years ago. The question is, how does consciousness change over history? And the book weaves the story. I believe the great changes in consciousness and the evolution of empathy occurs when two things happen. When we have new energy revolutions combining with new communication revolutions, and it happens. Infrequently over history, we change the way we organize energy, and then we change our communications technologies to organize the new energy regimes. That changes consciousness. I'll give you an example. Most of us have read about the Sumerians in Mesopotamia when we took high school anthropology. The Sumerians were the first to create hydraulic agriculture, the first civilization. That's in ancient Iraq. What they did is they captured the sun in photosynthesis in cereal plants, and the barley and wheat became stored energy, grain. Very complicated, because before that time, people lived in little villages, and they had rain-fed garden agriculture. with these big hydraulic civilizations, they had to indenture thousands of men to build those irrigation canals. Then they had to create craft skills to maneuver the dikes. They had to create royal granaries and royal roads and distribution. Really complicated. So they had to create a communication revolution to manage it, and was called cuneiform writing. Everywhere you see these great hydraulic agricultural civilizations, Middle East, India, China, Mexico, it's fascinating. Independently, people figure out how to create writing to organize it. Or if you come closer to home, 19th century, another convergence of communication and energy. The print revolution with steam power, print revolution, and mass literacy became the communication vehicle to organize coal, steam, and rail. You couldn't have done it with codecs. Too slow. In the 20th century, just passing, another convergence of communication energy, first-generation electricity, the telephone, and then cinema, radio, and television became the communication vehicles to organize and market and manage the internal combustion engine and the auto culture in the second industrial revolution, which sunsetted in 2008 in July at $147 a barrel. When these energy communication revolutions come together, the communication revolution not only organizes the new energy, it changes consciousness. If you go to a forager-hunter society, their communication was oral, just language. Every single one of them had mythological ways of thinking. If you go to the great hydraulic agricultural civilizations, which created writing, their consciousness was theological. All the great religions emerged at that time, theological ways of thinking. If you go to the 19th century with print communication, in the first industrial revolution, we ushered in ideological consciousness. That's what our grandparents were like. If you go to the 20th century with electricity and communication, we entered into psychological consciousness. We think psychologically. Grandma and grandpa couldn't think that. You couldn't say to grandma if she did something kind of passive-aggressive around the house, well, let's talk about why you did this. Can you go back to your childhood experiences and explain this? Grandma couldn't do that. So each of these communication energy civilizations changed consciousness, mythological, theological, ideological, psychological, and they actually expand empathy. They extend it. If you're in a little forager hunter society and your language is only shouting distance, it's oral, you don't have much of a range in terms of coming across diverse other people. So empathy is always blood ties. You empathize with your relatives and your kin, and that is it. Everyone else is the alien other. When you go to these great hydraulic civilizations and religious consciousness, people start affiliating by religious empathy. Jews empathize with Jews, Muslims with Muslims. When you go to the 19th century and industrial age, ideological consciousness, people start identifying by national origin. Americans start to see other Americans as extended family and empathize, the Germans with the Germans. So we have been moving empathy with all the blowbacks and all the Holocausts and all the genocides. We still have been moving forward from blood ties to religious ties to national ties. Now the question is, can we extend empathy to the biosphere and create a sustainable world?
What do you see as the evidence of empathy being displayed in our society today? There's certainly a lot of counterexamples.
There's a lot of counterexamples because we're in that very fuzzy twilight zone between the old way of thinking and the new way of thinking. There's a lot of fear and denial, etc. But I'll give you an example. When Haiti, the devastating earthquake, hit this month, within an hour or so on Twitter and in YouTube, the whole world knew. Massive empathic response of the human race. If we are, as the Enlightenment philosophers said we are, just detached, calculating, rational, autonomous little agents who pursue our own self-interest, why would there have been a human response on that scale to someone living far away that has no relationship to you? You remember when after the Iran elections, the flawed elections, there were protests among the students in the streets, and the government started shooting at the protesters. And one young college woman, a co-ed medical student, was gunned down. And someone had taken a cell phone video of it. And within an hour on YouTube, the whole world was watching and empathizing with those students in Iran. We now have the technologies that allow us to extend the central nervous system of human beings so we actually annihilate time and space and we can think as a human family very, very quickly.
What type of government is most compatible with empathy?
Well, that's interesting. I think the problem is the nation state, which was a product of the market economy. When we went to markets, national markets, and had the 19th century coal, steam, rail, and print technology, we could organize commerce and trade across larger regions. We created national markets, and the nation state became the governing institution to regulate and foster private property relations and market relations. But the nation states became a reflection of that same set of ideas about human nature. The nation state, on a macro level, was an autonomous agent detached, rational, self-interested, materialistic, competing with other nation states to seek power and control over resources. And now, though, we're in a global society. We're trying to come together in a global economy. The biosphere is threatened. We have to now start rethinking human nature. How do we live on a global scale? And as I say, it's really fortunate that we're beginning to discover that our really core nature is homeopathic, because otherwise I don't see how we would actually be able to make the turn. Let me say that I think we're on the convergence of a new third industrial revolution, a new convergence of communication and energy that might get us to the kind of sustainable world that you talk about on this show all the time. I have the good privilege of, I've advised the European Union for the last 10 years, and I've had the honor to set up the Third Industrial Revolution Long-Term Sustainability Plan for the EU, which was endorsed by the EU Parliament in 2007. And let me lay it out, because I think we need this desperately in the United States. We see another convergence of communication energy that could create distributed consciousness. We could start thinking as a human species, a biosphere awareness, biosphere politics, not geopolitics. It's based on the idea that we had a very powerful communication revolution in the last 10 years, the personal computer and the internet. This is what we call distributed communication, because now 2 billion people can communicate their own video, audio, and text to each other in a distributed fashion. So it allows us to extend the central nervous system of each person distributed around the world. Think file sharing, YouTube, Wikipedia. This distributed information communication revolution is just now converging with a new energy regime, distributed energy. And when distributed communication starts to organize distributed energy, we have a third industrial revolution that could create global empathic consciousness. Now, as you know, on the show, you've talked about distributed energy, I'm sure, a lot. That's renewable energy. Elite energies are coal, oil, gas, and uranium, because they're not found in your backyard. So they require huge military and geopolitical investments. But renewable energies are distributed. The sun shines everywhere and the wind blows, and we all have heat under the ground and the ocean tides and agricultural waste and municipal waste, etc. So these renewable energies are distributed because they're found in every square foot of the world. So the EU has committed itself to a four-pillar infrastructure for a new convergence of communication energy, third industrial revolution. Pillar one, 20% renewable energy by 2020. Wish we had that in America. A third of the electricity has to be renewable in 10 years. Pillar two, we are going to convert every single building in the European Union across 27 states, 500 million people, to a power plant in the next 25 years, every home, office, and factory, so that people can actually collect the renewable energy around their building. Solar from the roof, wind on the walls, heat under the ground, etc. Pillar three, we're going to store that distributed renewable energy in the form of hydrogen, because in Seattle, the sun isn't always shining, as we know. The wind isn't always blowing, so you have to, when you do have it out, you have to store it with hydrogen and then convert it back to electricity. And we've committed 8 billion euros to that in Europe. Then pillar four, this is where it gets interesting. This is where that distributed communication revolution of the internet converges with distributed energy to give us a powerful third industrial revolution. We use the exact same technologies that created the internet, thanks to Microsoft and other companies. And we take the power grid of Europe and hopefully America and the world and turn it to an intergrid that acts like the internet. So that when millions and millions of buildings across the EU are producing a little bit of their own energy from the renewable distributed energy surrounding their buildings, they store it in hydrogen like you store digital in media. And then what electricity they don't need, they share it peer-to-peer across an intergrid that acts just like the internet. And you create energy social spaces just like you have social spaces on the internet. That's power to the people. It's what we call distributed capitalism. And we think it can also create distributed consciousness. Because if everyone's responsible for that small swath of the biosphere where they're living, where they actually harness the renewable energy that bathes the planet where they're living, then share it across whole continents, then we become aware of our biosphere's responsibility for the energy that sustains life. That maybe can take us to an empathic civilization.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Jeremy Rifkin, author of the book The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World in Crisis. Would you expand on the relationship of the third industrial revolution that you just described and the development of empathy and how they interact with each other?
Well, you notice here in the Seattle schools and around the world, our young people are actually being taught a new form of consciousness. They're being taught that every single thing they do every day, the clothes they wear, the food they eat, the automobile their family uses, the electricity they turn on and off, they're being taught that their actual lifestyle and how they live in this world intimately affects the well-being of someone else somewhere else, a human or an animal or a plant, so that their use of the energy and resources of the earth can actually affect a farmer in Africa who, because of climate change, is experiencing drought and can't feed their family. This is the beginning of understanding biosphere awareness. This is the shift from geopolitics to biosphere politics. So our young people actually are learning that everything they do intimately affects every other living creature on this planet. That is brand new. You and I didn't have that. That's all in the last 5 years. Now we also have, because of the third industrial revolution, these distributed communication technologies and distributed energies that allow us to connect the central nervous system so we can communicate with each other and connect, and allow us to connect the energies that we all sustain life with so we can become one species. If we can learn to think as human beings, Homo empathicus, as a single species, then we will tend the biosphere. Then we will address climate change. Then we will understand our responsibility to our fellow creatures and future generations. If we can't create an empathic civilization, if we don't rethink our basic nature and understand we're Homo empathicus first, I don't think there's a plan B to get us where we want to go. I think we're in trouble as a species. So I think this is a turning point. I believe it's a daunting challenge, and I know people listening to this talk are going to say, we can't even pass welfare programs. We can't pass health reform in this country. We just had a Supreme Court that said that companies can finance anything they want in national elections. How can we talk about biosphere consciousness and empathic civilization? Well, you know, it's happening. That's the history you don't hear on the cable news. Cable news is all about the pathology, the bad things that happen. But the good thing is we're connecting the human race. And we need to now believe that that's the story, that's the human narrative we need to tell. We can't let it be drowned out by the pathological, by the sick, by the distorted, by the angry, by the frustrated that we see over and over again on cable news. We've got to start to tell this other story about the empathic side of the human race. If we are all truly despicable, materialistic, utilitarian son of a guns, the human race would have gone a long time ago. The fact is we're a social animal, and we reach out to each other to belong, and that's why we've really survived on this planet.
What most stands in the way of reaching global consciousness and acting with more empathy?
I think ultimately what stands in the way are these old 18th century ideas about human nature. They're embedded in our school system. They're embedded in our business models. They're embedded in some of our parenting styles. If you take a look at the schools that emerged in the 19th century, public schools emerged in Europe and America between 1830 and 1880, and then there was a slight reform movement, progressive movement before World War I in this country. Schools reflect the market economy and the nation-state priorities. Schools reflect this idea that human nature is self-interested, utilitarian, materialistic, and utilitarian. What do kids learn in school? Knowledge is power. Knowledge is not something you share, it's something you hoard. If you share it, it's cheating. And we learn very quickly that the idea is to have knowledge as power so that one can compete and pursue one's self-interest and be productive and be an autonomous agent in the world, correct? That's what we learn. That's our whole school model. But the strange thing is the kids growing up on the internet are a disconnect with this, because on the internet, they're learning to share information. They're learning to be collaborative. They're in open social spaces. Think file sharing. Think YouTube. Think Wikipedia. That's all open commons where they collaborate, they share, they distribute knowledge. But in school, we're taught that human nature is really self-interested, utilitarian, and you better get your own. We've got to rehaul the entire school system so that it reflects our basic core nature, which is to be empathic, not to be utilitarian and selfish and greedy. If we continue with this old idea of who we are, we become who we are. And so today, we wonder why there's so much acrimony. It's because we continue to think human nature is something different than what it really is in its core nature.
In your book, and earlier in the interview, you asked the question, can we reach biosphere consciousness and global empathy in time to avert a planetary collapse? What is your answer to this question?
Well, it's a paradox. In the empathic civilization, I deal with this paradox in history. It seems so obvious in hindsight, but no one's ever really discussed this in history. We have a paradox. It's kind of bittersweet. It's what I call the empathy entropy paradox. That is that as we develop more complex energy-consuming civilizations and new communication revolutions to manage them, it certainly has brought more diverse people together, heightened our consciousness, and allowed empathy to expand its domain to different types of folks in more urban settings. But those same civilizations use more energy, deplete more resources, to the disadvantage of the biosphere itself. Today, we're in a very complex, integrated, interdependent, connected global civilization, and our young people are actually glimpsing the possibility of thinking as a species, but that same civilization is using up vast amounts of energy and taking us to the actual cliff of our extinction. So we may be in that point where we can begin to actually, you remember the polar bear and her cub, the first time it came out on a YouTube video, a polar bear and her cub desperate on an ice floe in the Arctic because of climate change, and they were surrounded by open water and they couldn't survive. The whole human race empathized with that. So we're on the summit of the ability to actually start to think in those ways with all the xenophobism and the blowbacks and the fears. But at the same point, we may be near extinction, and it's bittersweet. We got to break that paradox. And I think a third industrial revolution at least gives us the possibility of breaking that paradox by beginning to create a distributed communication energy revolution and hopefully distribute consciousness so we think collaboratively as a human race, think internet, and we think a global commons and how do we live together in a global commons. It's daunting. I'm not betting on it. As you know in the book, I'm anything but Pollyannish. I think this is a hope for us. I think the jury is out, and I don't know if the younger generation is going to have the wherewithal to have a deep conversation. They're going to have to be disciplined and focused for three generations in order to get us to this new level from geopolitics to biosphere politics and to actually begin to think as Homo empathicus. I'm not sure we're going to make it. I hope we do.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The message is we need a global discussion. We need to rethink the human story. For all of those out there that are interested in sustainability and saving this planet and our fellow creatures and living more justly and sustainably in the world, we're not going to do it with the old way of thinking. We've got to really begin to understand that our core nature is not utilitarian and materialistic. That's a bill of goods we sold ourselves in the modern era, the industrial age. We are truly a social animal. And you know, the deathbed test is what we always look at. Late in life, when we are old and gray and look back on our life, we don't think of the precious moments as when we were autonomous agents and detached and rational and calculating and pursuing our self-interest. The photographs etched in our memory when we're old are the empathic moments where we connected with another human or another's creature and we transcended ourselves and we had solidarity and we struggled for each other's struggle to be. If that's truly what it's about, then what we need to do is we need to create a global conversation as powerful as the one that happened during the Enlightenment at the beginning of the market era. We're now at the beginning of the biosphere era, the global era, a global economy, and we need to have a conversation and get back to our root nature and ask, if we are Homo empathicus, how do we extend empathy to our species? How do we lay the groundwork for an empathic civilization? How do we rethink our education, our parenting, our business models, so our core natures will come out and the planet can be replenished?
Well, thanks so much for being here, Jeremy.
Thank you.
You have just been listening to Jeremy Rifkin, author of the book, The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World in Crisis, published in 2010 by Jeremy P. Tarcher, a member of Penguin Group USA. For more information, check on the web at www.empathiccivilization.org. Again, that's empathiccivilization.org. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the Streaming Archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters Sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP. .org.